Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the Lincoln family endured many tragedies, the loss of two children, and the assassination of the president. First Lady Mary Lincoln turned to spiritualism to cope, even holding seances in the White House. More on that ahead. As we approach Abraham Lincoln's birthday, we'll hear from an author about Lincoln's decision-making. While he was a politician, politics was not always behind his choices. What is statesmanship, and is it in short supply these days? The Paul Simon Public Policy Institute director will join us to discuss that more. We'll also hear about a new study to explore alternative options to treating young people with substance use disorders, and learn why it's a tough time to be a dairy farmer. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In the Lincoln White House, there was plenty of grief and personal tragedies. While the Civil War was raging, First Lady Mary Lincoln looked for solace and spirituality, seeking to contact those who were deceased. Jean Baker authored the book Mary Todd Lincoln, A Biography, and she talked with us about that part of Mary's life a decade ago. Today we listen back to some of that interview. Jean, the pursuit of spirituality, it's not hard to understand knowing what she was going through at the time.
Oh, indeed, and she joined literally millions of Americans in this effort to recall her dead children, and by the 1850s, 1860s, she had lost Eddie, one of her sons at four, and then tragically Willie in the White House in 1862, and she began to go to seances that were held in Georgetown and were supervised by various mediums. Then after Lincoln's assassination in 1865, there were even more reasons for her to try to recall all of this vanishing circle of her beloved relatives.
Is there any evidence of what she was? Was she trying to just get some type of response from people who had been who had passed on, or was she looking to convey some message or hear some message from them? Could you tell that?
It's a one-way operation. She is trying to keep in touch with those who are dead, especially these children. And she tells her half-sister Emily Helm, who comes to the White House, that Willie comes to her at night, and Mary Todd Lincoln is a very unusual, fascinating woman, but most Americans who were to some extent seduced by this opportunity of spiritualism believe that you can only find those who have passed beyond through the intervention of a medium, but in time, Mary Lincoln did away with the medium and believed that she could recall the dead without even going to these seances.
So she thought she had some power, that she was in some way a medium.
Yes, yes. That's a good word for Mary Todd Lincoln. She did believe that she had some power. But, I mean, the point here, and I think we're, as moderns, we too easily dismiss this movement in the 19th century, and we ridicule it, and who can believe that tables can elevate, etc. For really many, many Americans, and this is especially relevant during the Civil War when so many mothers and fathers lost their children on the battleground, this becomes an important solace.
We're talking with Jean Baker. She's an author and biographer of Mary Todd Lincoln, talking about spiritualism and Mary Todd's connection to that. Is there any evidence that she believed in this, or at least believed strongly in, you know, life after death, the ability to communicate with people who had passed on before some of these personal tragedies occurred?
Well, I don't know. There's not much evidence one way or the other. She was raised, as I've said, a Presbyterian, and she believed, evidently, as a good Presbyterian, in a resurrection. And she continued to be in touch with these with organized religion, which is one way that one thinks about what is it that happens when one's beloved relatives die. This is something that organized religion does, but it was also something that spiritualism did. And I believe very vigorously that we need to try to understand the appeal that spiritualism had for so many Americans during this period.
I'm guessing she was open to, you know, anybody that could give her, at least in her mind, some proof that they had communicated with relatives, with people who had died. And that would open you up to being taken by people who really, you know, were only looking at some way to either make money or find their way somehow into gaining some acceptance into the Lincoln White House.
Well, that's true. And there certainly is, it's interesting, and I have not figured out how the contemporaries knew this. There were fraudulent mediums, and then there were people like Nettie Colburn, who was a medium in Washington during the Civil War, and everybody believed her to be a reputable, responsible medium who could try to put them in touch with their dead relatives. So there certainly were frauds. There's a famous instance in the White House in which one of Lincoln's secretaries, who was not about to believe that this drum roll that is heard at a seance in Washington is actually from the outer space, so to speak. And so he gets up and grabs the Lord Colchester, who is the medium, and pulls him out, and here's this fleshy Englishman who is a fraud. But others were more successful at this process of intriguing and solacing and giving salvation to people like Mary Lincoln.
And that, in the end, is really what it was all about. You know, she got comfort from this, going
through this
difficult time.
That's right. And that's what we should probably remember spiritualism for. It was not an especially intellectual or organizational movement of spiritualism, but it was one in which individual mediums were able to accomplish a great deal. And there was, though, a danger, and part of Mary Lincoln's story. Eventually, her son, Robert, orchestrates this campaign to put her in a mental institution, and part of the reason that he does this, he argues that she's a spiritualist, and spiritualists are, in the psychiatric terms of the day, beset with a monomania, as they called it, and the monomania was this belief that you could actually be in touch with spirits from who were dead.
Well, how did the president view this activity? Was he involved in some way, or did he just view it as something that if it made her happy, he would go along with it?
Yeah. You know, Abraham Lincoln is curious about everything, whether it's machinery or politics. He certainly does come to, and there are at least 7 or 8 seances at the White House. He certainly does come to them, but he's, to me, by no means convinced. Lincoln would be, I think, much too skeptical to believe that there really were drums beating in the Red Room from the dead and departed. But he was a curious man, and he was married to a woman who was utterly committed to this. And I think that's the approach that he took.
Jean Baker is a biographer of Mary Lincoln. She talked with us about Mary's fascination with spirituality in the aftermath of personal tragedies. We're revisiting some interviews on Abraham Lincoln as his birthday nears next week. Let's go back to Lincoln's time. He's a politician up for re-election, holding firm to moral convictions, however politically unpopular, in the pursuit of preserving an endangered democracy. A biography by the historian John Meacham examines the life and legacy of Lincoln through a very specific lens. American presidents have lionized Lincoln as a role model, Meacham says, and he would know, as a biographer of George H.W. Bush and occasional speechwriter for President Biden. Meacham wasn't just interested in looking at what Lincoln did, he wanted to know why he did it. He focused especially on the president's pivotal decision to prioritize emancipation measures above his own political future in the lead-up to the 1864 election. NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke with him about it.
Lincoln was a politician, but he was a politician who ultimately was driven by conscience. This is my entire argument. If he had solely been a cynical political creature, he would have made radically different decisions at critical points.
Meacham's book, And There Was Light, tells of the anti-slavery politician whose election as president in 1860 triggered the Civil War. Lincoln struck back at the rebel states by ordering freedom for their enslaved workers, the Emancipation Proclamation. But the first Republican president was fiercely criticized by people who wanted less social change. And in 1864, he had to face the voters for re-election.
Henry Raymond, the editor of the New York Times and the chairman of the Republican National Committee, comes to the White House. He has said that the tide is setting against us and that if Lincoln wants to win re-election, he must give up emancipation as a precondition for peace.
Meacham's book reconstructs that moment. Lincoln's party had done badly in the midterm elections. Lincoln himself even wrote a private note forecasting his own defeat. He was urged to appeal to conservative voters by making some statement that he would back off his continued push for freedom.
And Lincoln said no, that he had made his position clear. He was willing to go down politically for that principle.
How did Lincoln think through that moment in, say, the summer of 1864?
He believed that slavery was wrong. He believed that he was right. He fundamentally understood that politics could not simply be about the amassing and keeping of power. It was about the amassing, keeping, and utilization of power. And I think the utility of it for us is that, not that he's perfect, but that here's a frail human being who didn't always get everything right, who in that critical hour transcended his limitations, transcended his ambitions, transcended his appetites to do the right thing. And fortunately, it was rewarded by events. But he didn't know that.
After refusing to retreat on slavery, Lincoln won the election anyway. And months later, his side won the war. In part, his calculation was ruthlessly practical. Men freed from slavery were joining the Union Army. Meacham argues the decision was also moral. Lincoln spoke of God a lot, although he was never a member of a church. His first inaugural address appealed to the better angels of our nature. And when that failed, his second inaugural address portrayed the war as God's punishment.
In the second inaugural, Lincoln says that the Civil War came because of slavery, and because slavery was a sin, and that God himself seemed to be adjudicating the weight of that sin in real time. So religion was both a rallying cry. It provided a predicate for the North, for the anti-slavery forces. And let us be very clear, and this is resonant today, it also provided an intellectual prop to slave owners who wanted to believe that slavery was divinely ordained.
Well, that's part of this speech, too. He acknowledges that both sides believed that God was on their side, but I believe he also suggests they may be both wrong.
He says both pray the same God, both ask for victory over the other. The prayers of neither have been fully answered. What is perennially frightening is that in American politics, in American culture, people do claim divine sanction for what they want to do. And if you claim divine sanction for what you want to do, that makes compromise very difficult. If you believe you are doing God's work, unless you do it with an immense amount of humility, that becomes a stumbling block within a democratic context in a way that is very, very troubling. At the same time, religion has been one of the great forces for reform and liberty in the country. My view of this, which I think is also the way Lincoln articulated, was that religion is going to be part of the human experience in the same way economics are always a part, or geography. And so the question is, how do you manage and marshal religious feeling, not try to remove it? There is a conscience, and you want to do everything you can to be in accord with this universal law of treating others as you would be treated. And that may sound simplistic, but I firmly believe, and I argue in this, that that was Lincoln's moral vision. And it's also, it has the virtue of being a durable political vision.
John, I want to anticipate a question I think you're going to get a lot. You're going to go out, you're going to do public events, you're going to do interviews in our current political environment. You've got this book that dwells on the Civil War. I think people are going to ask you, do you think we're heading for a civil war?
Tragically, I think we will see more of civil chaos. I think we're going to see it with violence. I do not believe we're going to see the massing of great armies in the way we did in the 19th century. But we are at greater risk, and part of it is that there is a passionate minority that is putting its own interests ahead of those of the nation, and the nation as defined with that kind of moral sensibility we've discussed. But I'm fundamentally hopeful in this sense, that we have stared into the abyss before, and just enough of us have decided to do the right thing. And as Lincoln said about our better angels, those better angels won't prevail unless we enlist ourselves in the cause, too.
John Meacham is the author of And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
We'll talk statesmanship. That's just ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. Paul Simon Public Policy Institute Director John Shaw wrote the booklet Restoring American Statesmanship, A Citizen's Guide. Shaw created a class at SIU around it. Then, ignited by a student's question, he wrote How to Become a Statesperson. And now he's out with Statesmanship 101.
Every teacher will tell you learn more from your students than maybe they learn from you. And in this case, I taught a class for honors called Restoring American Statesmanship. And so we talked about, you know, the founders and Lincoln and Eisenhower and Kennedy and the whole range in American history. And then at the end of the class, I had this one of these great moments where a student came up to me and he had been sitting quietly through most of the class and asked good questions and so forth, but hadn't said too much. And he pulled me aside and he said, you know, I really like the class. Thank you so much for it. By the way, I have one question for you. And I said, oh, sure. What is it? And he says, how do I actually become a statesman? And I kind of muttered a perhaps not totally persuasive response, but it led me to think about the broader question about how do you become a leader? How do you become a statesperson? I started thinking, it's like, you know, why not put together a guide for students that deals with such things as their education, early career, mentors, books to read, skills to develop. And so it prompted really about a 3 or 4 month project where I read a lot and, you know, talked to people and thought about my own career and so forth. So I put together this guide about how to become a statesperson. And it is, you know, you call it a practical and aspirational guide because I hope it provides some kind of practical things about, you know, how do you find mentors? How do you look for mentors? How do you appreciate mentors? You know, what kind of skills do you need to develop as you launch your career? You know, how should you approach jobs? What happens when you have a job that doesn't seem to be going anywhere? What do you do? Do you bolt? Do you just dig in and try to, you know, work your way through it? Again, there's no perfect answer, but this was an attempt to kind of sketch it out, and it was something that I feel good about. And I had some students who reviewed it. In fact, a student who I actually supervised an independence study course in statesmanship. I had sent him a draft, and he was mostly favorable, but one comment was, he said, this draft would be better if it had more grit, less romanticism. So I kind of smiled at the audacity of that comment, but there was some truth to his assertion. So that's something that we'll release this fall. And, you know, whenever I see a student, I hand them a copy. They're handed out at our events. Copies can be downloaded on our website. People can reach out to us. So I think it's a way of just continuing our work on the kind of elusive concept of statesmanship. It's something I've been interested in my entire career. I've spent a lot of time trying to even understand what it is, because it is a concept that has been unpacked and debated by philosophers going back to Aristotle and Plato, the Renaissance thinkers, Enlightenment thinkers, the founding fathers, Abraham Lincoln. I mean, just and I think you can get caught up in a lot of the, you know, esoteric descriptions and so forth. But to me, you know, statesmanship at its core is just exceptional leadership, usually in the political realm. Statesmanship that leadership that focuses on the public interest rather than the personal interest, and it's a kind of leadership that is willing to take risks, that thinks in the long term, that is willing to make hard decisions and even risk political careers.
To kind of put this in terms that maybe a lot of us can understand, who would you say, is there a quintessential, maybe a politician, who would kind of embody statesmanship?
For me, I mean, you know, this is maybe cliche, but it's Abraham Lincoln. I mean, because, and here, you know, Lincoln is both this, you know, very deep philosophical thinker, a practical politician, a problem solver. And even when, you know, we think about his leadership in the Civil War, you know, imperfect to be sure, made lots of mistakes, but had a really clear, broad strategic objective. But we also forget, during the midst of the Civil War, Lincoln was also approving legislation to create land-grant colleges, approve legislation to make a railroad across the continental United States, supported legislation for the Homestead Act to settle the country. So, I mean, here you are in the midst of the most intense crisis imaginable, and Lincoln is also supporting policies for the long term, you know, things that will not really affect him, but will affect, you know, generations to come. And I think it was George Washington said, you know, when you look at policies, you should think about its impact on the 100th generation. Just this notion of thinking ahead, and contrast it with our current politics, in which it seems, you know, obviously technology, social media, but there's such intense pressure to react to every event, to every moment. And I think this notion of short-term survival has taken precedence over long-term leadership and stewardship. And so that's one of the things we're trying to do with our statesmanship work, is to just to remind students that, first of all, that America has a real tradition of excellent political leadership. I would argue the last 20 years have been one of the lowest points. You know, from 9/11 on, there has been just, a cascade of failures and, you know, leadership that has been disappointing. So part of this project is to sort of let students know that Americans have done leadership and politics much better than we are doing now. Also to remind some of us older folks that we do have a tradition that should be looked to and drawn upon and appreciated.
Is the term statesmanship, is that something that you're, in a sense, born with, or is it a learned behavior? How would you describe it?
That's a great question. I do think it's a learned behavior. I think it is just and it's not some, you know, special skill that's conferred, you know, by the divine. I mean, it's just, and a lot of it is just, statesmanship does not suggest or connote perfection. You know, some of the leading statesmen, you know, have failed plenty. I mean, you know, maybe one of the great statesmen in certainly the 20th century is Winston Churchill. And it has been said of Churchill that he got everything wrong except Hitler. which was a pretty big thing to get right. So statesmanship includes failure and disappointments and setbacks. But to me, its quintessential element is just looking to the future and being willing to take risks and putting your career on the line if need be. But it's also interesting, and this is something that I'm really proud of, is that one of our initiatives is we've created a statesmanship program in Illinois with Governor Edgar, former Governor Edgar, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago. But, you know, Governor Edgar and I talked about creating a statesmanship award in Illinois, and the focus is let's look at mayors and city council members and, you know, people at state and local government, and see what they are doing to take risks and to build their communities. And one of my favorite examples, 2 years ago, we decided to give the award to the mayor of Ottawa, Illinois. And this was a gentleman, Robert Eschbach is his name, who he was an Ottawa native, went to U of I Law School, came back home, built a law practice, became a pillar of the community, and for 20 years was mayor. And did some hard creative things to rebuild the town's economy, to beautify the city, to improve it for floodplain protection. I mean, it's an example of someone who just returned home, and a small community, I think 18,000 people, just stayed and built and made it better. So to me, that's a wonderful example of statesmanship. I mean, I've done writing on, you know, leaders in higher education who are taking really tough risk, particularly in this current climate. So statesmanship, I see, is not specific to politics. It's most interesting to me in the political realm, but it includes higher education, religion, journalism, arguably. So I think it is a quality of leadership that is pervasive, but also has become less pronounced in American life. And I'm trying to put a focus on it and see if we can start getting some of these statesmanship muscles reactivated.
And I was going to ask you something along those lines. You touched on from the political realm about how the need to react immediately to things is kind of, we push statesmanship to the side. Is statesmanship going by the wayside in all aspects of life?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are examples. And again, I cited this mayor from Ottawa, Illinois. This year's statesmanship award went to a former village president of Barrington Hills, who also stayed in her community and did some remarkable work. So, I mean, I think it's harder to do. The politics, are so charged and so polarized, but there's still examples of people who are willing to put their careers on the line. I mean, not to be too political here, Liz Cheney was willing to put her career on the line because she felt that a peaceful transfer of power was imperative. And when she felt that that was not occurring in 2020, said, no further, I cannot accept this. Adam Kinzinger, congressman from Illinois, same thing, a good, loyal Republican, but just felt that with the inability of Donald Trump in 2020 to accept the presidential results, that something fundamental had broken, and he was willing to risk his political career to stand up. So that is continuing, and there are examples of leaders who are willing to put it all on the line. I mean, that we don't see it as much as we would like, and one of my hopes is to just kind of rebuild statesmanship as an aspiration, something that students and young people think about as an ideal, you know. And once you have that ideal, you can start of, you know, managing your career to make it, you know, make it alive in your day-to-day work.
You touched on Cheney and Kinzinger. They basically lost their political careers by what they did. Can a president be elected these days, in your opinion, trying to portray a statesmanship point of view, as you said, that long-term focus down the road?
I don't know. I mean, it's, but I'll say in relatively recent American history, I've seen plenty of examples of statesmanship. Some years ago, I wrote a book about Richard Lugar, the senator from Indiana, Republican senator, conservative Republican, but he had this view that his job was to work for the public interest, the national interest. And in the, because of that, he was willing in the mid-80s to challenge Ronald Reagan, the president of his party, on the issue of apartheid. He thought Reagan should be supportive of efforts to dismantle apartheid. So he challenged a popular president of his own party. A couple decades later, he worked with Barack Obama, a Democrat, a leader of the other party, to pass an arms control treaty through the Senate. You know, here was someone who was a six-term senator, so it's not as if, you know, I mean, he found a way to make it work, and he ultimately was defeated, but he had this magical, you know, important career. So I see examples of statesmanship in American life. I mean, I think you could argue that Jimmy Carter was a statesman. I think, you know, many would say Ronald Reagan. So I think it's possible, and I think that, and this is a critical point, I think we really need it as we start looking to the future. And when you talk about climate change, you talk about immigration, you talk about our deficits and debt problem, talk about public health and the likelihood that we're going to have a pandemic at some point in the not too distant future. We need that kind of leadership to start being a kind of a normal aspect of our political system, or we're going to be in really deep trouble.
How to Become a Statesperson is out new this fall, and even newer, just out now, is Statesmanship 101. Give us an idea of what this is all about.
Well, this was something that a couple of years ago we did a book called Illinois 101. And the notion to that was, okay, if you were teaching a class on an Illinois history, you know, what are the five books you would recommend? So for Illinois 101, I reached out to Senator Durbin, to Governor Edgar, to Ray LaHood, Speaker Welch, and asked them, okay, if you were teaching a class in Illinois history, you know, what were the five books you'd recommend? And we got this tremendous response, put together a booklet, and sent it out to public libraries across the state, to legislative offices. So my thought was, let's do something similar for statesmanship. And so I approached about 25 leading diplomats and scholars and said, if you're teaching a course on statesmanship, you know, what are the five books you would recommend? And, you know, we have three or four Pulitzer Prize-winning historians and biographers. We have, you know, some leading diplomats. So it's a really interesting, rich array of books that have been recommended. You know, lots of books that refer to, you know, the Founding Fathers, to, you know, the Greeks. Interestingly, a number of people suggested the book by Machiavelli called The Prince, which is in some sense the anti-statesman. This was someone who, in a somewhat satirical way, posited a type of leadership that is very practical and transactional, and very kind of, in some sense, cynical. But I think a number of people thought that you know, sometimes to put up the kind of counterexample is sometimes illuminating to see what the ideal should be. So in any case, these are over 100 titles that have been suggested. And for people who are looking for books to read on the theme of statesmanship, again, it's on our website. We'll be handing it out at our events. And it's free, and it's a nice little booklet that they can use as they will.
Yeah, I want to make sure that people understand these are short booklets, easy to consume. I mean, they're, what, 50, 60 pages at top. So these are something you can easily get through.
Yeah, they are. And my colleague Will Beck, our communications person, has done a really terrific job in designing them. So they're very readable, very attractive, easy to carry around. And I hope that they are useful, particularly for the student guide. I really would love students to just to take a look at it. And part of it, I have to say, as I was working on this, was like, what is the kind of booklet my 20-year-old self would have loved to have had as I began my career? Just some sort of guide to start thinking about how to manage careers and how to you know, sharpen your education. One of the big themes is just lifelong education. The fact that once you graduate from SIU or elsewhere, hopefully that's just the beginning of your education, and you continue to read and think and develop skills. I hope these guides are really helpful for people as they think about the future. And even for older folks, it's never too late to display statesmanship. City council members, you know, library board members, you know, there's these moments when you come to tough decisions and there's an easy way, and there's a hard way. And the hard way is oftentimes the right way. And so, you know, this guide hopefully will even encourage people much later in their careers to think hard about the kind of leadership they want to display and the kind of legacy they want to leave.
Paul Simon Public Policy Director John Shaw. He's authored books on statesmanship. Now he's out with Statesmanship 101. Thanks to WSIU for that segment. This is Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Milk prices are now below many dairy farmers' break-even points after a steady price decline since January of last year. It's the latest symptom of a volatile milk economy that's pushed some farmers to open side businesses just to stay afloat. Harvest Public Media's Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval reports.
Quincy Schmidt's family has owned their dairy farm in Corcoran, Minnesota, an hour outside of the Twin Cities, since 1958, when her grandpa first scouted the area.
He hopped in his pickup one day, and he bought the farm with 20 cows and a horse, and we kind of have grown our farm from there.
When Schmidt was growing up, the family had about 50 cows. And the herd expanded over time.
As we became adults and were interested in the farm, we increased our herd. We're now milking 120 cows, and yeah, they're pretty friendly. They're a friendly bunch.
But for the past 5 years, dairy prices have been volatile. They're currently running a few dollars below many farmers' break-even points. Profit margins at Schmidt's family's farm started shrinking.
Dairy isn't always a consistent form of income. If other dairy farmers can relate, the prices are pretty low. They've been very low for a while. It's not always the same check you see coming in every. It's not a consistent check.
Thus, their side business, Curious Cows and Company, was born. For $25, visitors can spend 30 minutes snuggling calves, brushing their coats, or feeding them hay. I tried filming myself cuddling with cows, in fact, until one of them thought my hair was edible. In the business. Ah! But why have dairy prices been declining? One part of it is that there's a dairy glut that's outpacing demand. Christopher Wolf is an ag economist at Cornell University. He says people tend to consume a lot of these dairy products when they eat out.
They're more likely to, people eat more cheeses, more specialty cheese in particular, and things like that when they eat out.
But he says with inflation still relatively high, people are eating out less, and that cuts into dairy consumption.
So right now, inflation is still being kind of stubborn, and everything that's happening right now doesn't look like it's going to do much for curbing inflation. So when people go out less, it also has impacts.
Which is precisely why dairy businesses across the country have delved into agritourism and diversified their product lines to generate as much revenue as possible. This isn't a new idea to Jeff Swanson, a tour manager at Country Dairy in Michigan.
That's part of the reason why we put in our own bottling plant, because in the late 70s and early 80s, milk prices were really low and a lot of farmers were selling out.
Country Dairy not only bottles its own milk, but also operates its own ice cream line, offers tours, and even has a small restaurant on its farm. Swanson says the idea of the special products and tours is also about helping people to understand farming.
People who really have a disconnect with farms today, to be able to educate them and help them know what a modern dairy farm is like.
Swanson says this has allowed their farm to remain relatively independent from major milk market forces. Their focus is to provide quality milk to their customers and offer some unique time on the farm.
So this year, we're also going to be doing classes on Thursdays, and we call it Moo University or Moo U. And we are doing that to try and open up farming even more to people.
That's been a recurring theme through conversations with different dairy farmers. These side businesses aren't just about bringing in more cash. They're also meant to connect people. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
About 1 in 7 young adults in the U.S. meet the criteria of a substance use disorder. For different reasons, young adults are the age range least likely to get assistance from services to help them. The Lighthouse Institute, the research arm of the Bloomington-based Chestnut Health Systems, is launching a new research study to explore alternative options to traditional treatment. Ben Howell has that story.
Substance use disorder is defined in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a psychological condition. Dr. Tess Drozdowski is part of the research team. She's a research specialist with Chestnut and a licensed clinical psychologist.
There's different symptoms that are set out, but broadly, what needs to be happening? They need to be using substances, and it needs to be causing some kind of impairment in their life, either legal or social, financial. And so that those pieces need to be met.
Another condition is a physiological response, or a difficulty stopping drug use even when someone wants to. Drozdowski notes young adults are the most difficult group to reach in substance use care.
We know that young adults, so that 18 to 26-year-old age range, is the age group that's the least likely to access substance use services, and when they do, they're the least likely to stay engaged.
In order to meet the needs of young adults, Chestnut Health System's Lighthouse Institute is recruiting 48 young adults from across central Illinois who are battling the disorder, along with their families, to help find alternative treatment plans. Drozdowski says young adults struggle with traditional treatment plans, such as outpatient or research clinics. Sometimes they don't have the means to get there, or they don't like being in a medical environment. Young adults are also most likely to say they don't need the care in the first place.
You're becoming an official adult. You're often changing your where you're going to school, where your living situation is. Romantic partners are changing, and you might be becoming a parent yourself during that age range.
So Lighthouse Institute wants to bring the treatment to the young adults and their families directly. The Institute's six-month research study will provide free, personalized recovery support services for the young adults.
Where they get connected with a peer recovery support specialist who has been trained by us to also provide educational, vocational, skill building, and goal setting.
Chestnut describes the research as a groundbreaking initiative. Traditionally, parents or caregivers are not brought into the care.
It's by engaging their parents, their loved ones, and peer workers to try to get them the support they need out in the community, out where they already are, instead of making them come into services.
Parents or anyone willing to provide support for the patient can receive care as well. Lighthouse Institute will provide parents with a coach to learn recovery skills and language for them to use in helping their child. Once data from the study is collected, Lighthouse's research team will assess how often families use the support they provided and whether it worked.
So is there even a need in the community for this? Are people interested in these services? Do they seek them out? And then if they do seek them out, how can we make them better? Is this helpful? Is this not? What can we do?
If successful, the project would expand to include more families. The project will depend on initial and continued surveys completed by the families, as well as a final interview at the end of the program. Lighthouse is also offering a guarantee to families that their information and answers will not be publicly shared.
All this information is confidential, so it's all protected behind federal rules around research data. We even have a certificate of confidentiality for this project, which means even if we were subpoenaed by a judge, we can't release the data from this particular project.
Families interested in participating in the research study from Chestnut can contact them on their website. If families don't qualify, other services are available. With reporting from Eric Stock, I'm Ben Howell.
Two Northern Illinois school districts have seen a big increase in homeless students. Peter Medlin investigated to find out why.
Two elementary schools 7 miles apart, Richmond Elementary and Wegner. Richmond is in St. Charles, where their percentage of low-income students is just a fraction of the state average. Wegner is in West Chicago, where it's a good deal above it. But both schools have seen a sharp increase in their homeless student population over the past few years. The state average is 3%, but it's around 18% at Wegner, and at Richmond, it's 21% of students. And in a district like St. Charles, Richmond's an outlier. In West Chicago, Wegner's more of a trend.
And they come in here, they stop first in the meat area,
Daisy Martinez with the People's Resource Center walks me through the aisles of a food bank she helps run. We're in a West Chicago school building, and a majority of the 100 families who shop here have kids in the district. There are schools on either side of the building, and the pantry opens up after school, so Martinez says parents often stop by with their kids when they pick them up.
That or before their kid goes to the other events like orchestra, band, and like sports and stuff. So I see some kids come through with their gear on and they're like, are we ready to go? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm trying to get you through, I promise.
Sarah Norden says the pantry is one of many community resources the district is part of and can point parents towards. She's the West Chicago Elementary School District's Director of Partnerships, and she's also their McKinney-Vento liaison. McKinney-Vento is the federal law that guarantees the right to education for homeless students. And homeless, in this context, means they don't have fixed, regular, or adequate housing. Often that looks like families doubled up because they can't afford a place on their own. And Norton says McKinney-Vento is also a funding source to help those students get transportation, clothes, and school supplies.
We have 450 students who are McKinney-Vento eligible from our Bursa 3 program all the way to 8th grade.
In West Chicago, Wegner's seen a big increase over the past few years, but so is the whole district. In 2019, fewer than 2% of the district students qualified as homeless. This year, it's 10%. That's a 400% increase. And Norton says that's partially because of economic conditions and partially because they're getting better at identifying homeless students. Pre-pandemic, she says it was on parents during registration to self-identify that they had unstable housing.
So we did update registration processes and make sure there's a question in our annual student registration that asks about unstable housing. And it lists those three things, like, are you doubled up? Are you in adequate housing? Is it consistent? So anytime somebody checks that box during registration, we now follow up with them.
She says they've also been trained to identify the warning signs of homelessness, but there are also just more homeless students now. And that's for multiple reasons, from rising cost of living to the fact that they've had two major apartment fires over the past few years that displaced families overnight. But why are the numbers so much bigger at Wegner Elementary, where nearly 18% of their students are homeless? Norton says it's near one of their largest apartment complexes where families are doubled up.
It's not because, oh, we all get along and we want to share housing. It's because they can't afford rent anywhere in West Chicago without combining their finances and living together. And it's not necessarily both families' names on the lease. It's very easy if you were to get caught that you'd be at risk of losing housing, both the person who has their name on the lease and the other family staying with them.
She says the district works closely with community partners to provide case management and after-school programming for those students, but it's particularly hard because once families are priced out of West Chicago, the surrounding suburbs are usually even more expensive. One of those surrounding suburbs is neighboring St. Charles, home to Richmond Elementary, which has a rate of homelessness about 10 times higher than the rest of their school district. Atlee Smith is the district's family community liaison.
A lot of people hear St. Charles and they think, well, we don't have, you know, low-income housing here. We don't have affordable housing. And that, I think, is one of the biggest, you know, misconceptions that I've really worked hard to bust.
2 years ago, the district shifted school boundaries and reclassified Richmond from an intermediate to an elementary school, and they knew it could concentrate more low-income students at Richmond and a few other schools. And they had a lot of community partners who wanted to help, but they needed to be more deliberate. So this year, they created an essential needs form to help get students the things the district can't purchase with McKinney-Vento money.
Maybe it's prom tickets or it's track shoes. And we will take that need from our social worker, our school staff, put it into our essential needs form. It'll go out to our community lead, and she will email everyone in that network, and someone will say, I'll grab them.
Smith helps compile a monthly calendar with frequently needed items depending on the season, like Halloween costumes in September. The St. Charles School District also partners with the nonprofit Big Hearts of Fox Valley to help get Christmas presents for their McKinney-Vento families. They recently held their Santa's drive-thru event on a cold December night, and families like this one pulled up in their cars to pick up the presents.
So I'm a foster mom and have two little boys who have a homeless status, and it just means the world to get these presents for them. They get so overwhelmed and overjoyed. They've never seen anything like it. So it also just blesses our family and provides tremendous support for us as a foster family.
Big Hearts works directly with the school district social workers to get kids wish lists so people in the community can buy for them. This year, they gave away well over 10,000 gifts. And Smith says it is possible that they'll continue to see high levels of homelessness at schools like Richmond, but she says she feels confident that they now have the systems in place to support those kids. I'm Peter Medlin.
We're out of time for Statewide, and remember to join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can also find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.